Hello. In tonight's Quantum Leap, we get dressed up in clothes that aren't just smart, they're downright intelligent. In the second part of our report on satellite navigation systems, we try to get lost in West Cork and we hear about the latest weather conditions on the sun. But we begin with the best reason I've come across for learning a party piece. New Irish research has found that if you learn off 500 words of a poem or a text every week, it'll help keep your memory healthy. Joining me now is one of the research team, Dr. Richard Roach from the Department of Psychology at NUI Maynooth. Richard, this project began a number of years ago when you ran an ad in the Evening Herald. Were you looking for people who had trouble remembering things or people who had very good memories?
No, we really looked for an average memory ability in people. We had to exclude people who would have had very poor memory because there was a risk of maybe a worry that people might have had specific memory problems like early onset dementia or Alzheimer's. So we just wanted people who had a fairly regular average type memory. We're interested in maintaining it and keeping it in good condition.
Okay. Now, they were asked to learn off 500 words of a text or a poem every week for, I think it was 6 weeks, and then you tested them before, during and after, and even then at an interval again. What did you find?
Well, our prediction was that if people engaged in this prolonged period of rote learning, that we would see improvements in memory at the end of that six-week period. But the results were a bit of a surprise, actually. We saw no difference at the end of the 6 weeks of learning, which was a shock. But after a further 6 weeks of rest, when they had done nothing, we saw improvements in some of the memory tests we'd given them. And the improvements were restricted to tests of verbal and episodic memory, so the types of memory you can express in words, as opposed to visual-spatial types of memory. There was no change on those.
They don't remember what they saw on the way to work last week, but they can remember
Events that had happened to them and various things that happened during the week.
Okay, one of your colleagues, Jonathan McNulty, who was then in Beaumont, now in UCD, I think, actually did brain scans. What turned up in the brain scans?
We picked out particular areas of the brain that we were interested in because they have a role in memory that we know from previous research. So we were looking at the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus. And we were looking at changes in brain chemistry and metabolism in these areas. And what we saw was that over the period where their memories had improved, so between week 6 and week 12, we saw increases and changes in brain chemistry that suggested that the cells in this part of the brain were actually in a healthier state and they were fit and active properly the way they should be.
So learning something is good for the brain?
It is. It's a bit like exercise for a muscle in the body. To keep the brain fit and healthy, we should keep it exercised and nurtured over a long period of time.
So what are you recommending now? Sudoku, playing bridge, Scrabble?
Yeah, just any types of mental exercise to keep the brain in good shape and keeps it fit and healthy should keep it functioning properly into later life, yeah.
Very good. Do you yourself learn off a poem every week now?
I try to do a Sudoku on the train when I go into work, but I haven't got around to poetry yet, no.
Okay, one to work up to. Dr. Richard Roach from the Department of Psychology and NUI Maynooth, thank you very much.
Thanks.
You're listening to The Quantum Leap with me, Mary Mulvihill. Still to come, our review of satellite navigation systems for drivers. But first, it used to be that smart clothes meant that snappy black number that never went out of fashion, or maybe nowadays the latest designer creation. But Lucy Dunn is a researcher in UCD who's giving smart clothes a whole new meaning. Our reporter, the very elegantly dressed Terry Flanagan, went off to visit Lucy Dunn, and she began by explaining just what she means by smart clothes.
Smart clothing is more or less regular clothing, which has been augmented with sensors or actuators so that it either detects something from the person that's wearing it or provides a surface to the person who's wearing it or communicates something to people who see the person wearing it.
Now, the garment you have here on the desk is like a kind of an underlay jacket, and yet you're running some fibre optics down the back of it. Why?
This shirt here monitors the position of your spine. It's intended to be sort of a posture monitor for people who work at computers. So the fiber optic element that runs down the center of the back is able to detect the curvature of your spine, and then it transmits that wirelessly to your desktop computer.
Which you have set up here.
I do. And the computer is monitoring that stream of data and looking for changes that would indicate that you're sitting in poor posture. And if you sit in poor posture for too long, then it tells you maybe you should correct that.
And what you have there is you have a little icon on the bottom of the screen, and it's green at the moment.
Yep.
But if your posture disimproves, it turns red.
Yep, it goes from green through yellow into red. So it's sort of just a subtle little ambient display, a little system tray icon. It's not meant to really be disruptive or annoying, but if you're sitting badly for too long, it will pop up a little message balloon that says maybe you should sit up.
Okay, can we go across your lab here and head over to what I think you refer to as the expressive dress. It's an absolutely beautiful dress. It's a silver colored dress with a beautiful red bar running through the center of it. Explain.
Well, this dress is part of a line of four garments that was presented in a fashion show. They're sort of meant to take things that are not normally visible, physiological signals that are sort of tied to your emotional responses, and make them visible. So it raises a lot of questions about this area of wearable technology, where you could actually be expressing things that maybe you wouldn't be able to express normally.
Now, what does this dress express?
The red slash through the center is a electroluminescent panel, and it basically flashes with your heartbeat, so it's like wearing your heart.
I've heard of wearing your heart in your sleeve, but here you're actually wearing it on the outside of your body, on your chest.
Yes, it's so sort of near where your heart really is.
So that means if you're wearing that dress and you meet me some night in a pub or that, and you fancy me, then it flashes away.
Well, it would flash faster if my heart rate sped up.
Okay, of course, so it's flashing all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. People would be able to maybe deduce things from what they see. Maybe deduce that you were feeling, you know, more alert or more scared or more excited, things like that.
Okay, let's move over to the rail here. I see a number of jackets. Run us through some of these. What about that silvery one there first, kind of grey silver one? Yes, that one.
This one is sort of...
it's flashing.
Oh, it's
there's a blue line.
It's got a little electroluminescent bit of piping, which is meant for...
Oh, there it is, flashing again. Let me just say, it's a jacket with these lines running down the front of it and also down the back of it and down the shoulders, and they're flashing on and off. Oh.
It basically responds to light levels. So this jacket is sort of intended for people who maybe cycle at night or go jogging or walking. It's kind of the more modern version of that garish yellow vest. So rather than those vests respond or function using, you know, bright colors or retroreflective tape, but this one actually generates light. So if the jacket detects that it's too dark out, then it lights up this piping and people can see you more easily in the dark.
So there must be a battery somewhere in it. Is there a power source?
There is. There's an elastic bit around the waist that holds a few battery packs.
Okay. And they're quite small, too.
The one for the light is fairly small. The jacket has another function, which is that it also monitors the temperature of the airspace between the jacket and your body. So if it decides that you're getting too cold, there's a textile-based heating panel in the back of the jacket, which is activated, and that will warm you up. It actually warms up to quite a
You'd never notice it. I'm just running my hand through it there. You wouldn't even feel it.
Yeah, well, the heating panel, a lot of electric blankets and things like that are based on wires, and it's basically a resistive heating. This one, instead of wires, they've taken conductive yarns, and it's the same resistive heating principle, which eats a lot of power, but makes it into a soft, pliable, textile-based form.
Okay, and that black jacket there, I see it's actually vibrating here at the front. There's little beads vibrating on it.
This vest has an array of vibrating pager motors, which sort of just, it's a cute little sort of vibrating massage function. And it's set up so that you can actually see it. And when the motors vibrate, they sort of bounce a little group of beads around within a bubble. So you might be able to hear it even.
Oh, yes. And why would somebody want to wear that?
That one's just sort of a little, you know, cute, gadgety, you know, convenience function. Maybe you're stressed at work. Maybe you need a little shoulder or back massage. So that's just what it's about.
Okay, and what about this, the grey jacket? It's like a suit jacket here. There's shoulder pads I see in it.
This one has an embedded vibro-tactile display. So the idea of it is that it's integrated into it like a suit jacket, something you'd wear in the office or in a business environment. And the idea of it is that often personal technologies like mobile phones or PDAs or laptops are really useful in these kind of situations, you know, in your work environment, but that maybe they're not socially acceptable. So if your phone rings in the middle of a meeting, that's sort of disruptive and annoying and can be considered rude, but maybe you do need to receive the information that the phone is trying to transmit. So what we've done is embed this little tactile display, which communicates information by vibrating, so you can feel it through your skin instead of having to hear it or see it.
And what's built into this one?
The same kind of vibrating motors that are in the one that you just heard, but they're integrated into the shoulder pads of the garment. So you don't feel them and you don't see them. They're just sort of embedded within the jacket itself.
And how many are in that jacket?
There's four in each shoulder, so they can provide sort of an array of moving patterns or static patterns or flashing patterns.
So you could have one, for instance, for your mobile phone.
You could. You could have a pattern that says there's an incoming call. You could have a pattern that says how important it is. You know, you could even maybe be receiving messages from a collaborator in maybe a negotiation scenario where you have a team that's negotiating with another team and you want to be able to talk to each other, but you don't want them to know that you're talking. So maybe you have a pattern that means yes or no or things like that.
A bit like spy stuff, is it?
Exactly, yeah.
Get smart and 99, is that right?
Something like that.
Well, I'm thinking of this one here too. You could also build in or tie it in with your GPS system.
You could, and it could
instead of having to watch the monitor on the screen, you could have these on your back or on your arms or something telling you to go left, go right, and so on.
Exactly. That's one of the first uses of tactile displays in wearable technology was for airplane pilots who fly in complex maneuvers, and sometimes they lose track of which direction is the ground and which direction is the sky, and depending on where they are and what the ground and the sky look like, they can confuse one for the other and actually head straight for the ground. So there were a lot of accidents, and they discovered that a tactile display was a much more efficient way for them to know which way was up, because if you can feel it, it's a lot more intuitive than looking at a dial and trying to figure out what that reading means.
So we've gone through a few of them here on the rail here. There's probably another half dozen that we won't get a chance to get through. Is the future then in this type of clothing?
I hope it is, otherwise I won't have a job. I think so. You're starting to see a few things hit the commercial market.
Like what?
Well, Nike Plus iPod, that has just come out with the little, it's got a little gizmo that goes into your shoe, and then it communicates your distance and I think time to your iPod, which interrupts the music every once in a while to tell you how you're doing. And you can do like customized workout patterns and things like that. Adidas is also partnered with Polar, the heart monitor maker, and they've developed a similar kind of system that actually incorporates a heart monitor into a shirt that you wear, and the heart monitor sends its data to a watch and data from your shoe as well, so it keeps track of distance and things like that as well.
So in 20 years' time, we'll all be wearing wearable clothes.
Hopefully, but hopefully you won't notice that you're wearing anything different. It'll just do everything better.
Well, I'd have to say the nicest one of all here is the red dress.
That's just because it's shiny.
That was UCD researcher Lucy Dunn with her smart clothes and her wearable technology. And as a city cyclist, I'd have to say I'd certainly be very interested in her flashing high visibility jacket. And that report was by our fashion correspondent, Terry Flanagan. Now, in last week's programme, we were talking about GPS and satellite navigation systems, and in our follow-up report this week, I'm joined by Peter Mooney here in Dublin and Leanne O'Donnell in our Cork studio, and they've been taking a range of systems for a test drive for us. Peter, what systems did you look at?
Mary, we tried four systems. Microsoft AutoRoute, which is a piece of software that you install on your laptop and your PC and run it from there. Copilot is a system that works on smart mobile phones. They're the kind of state-of-the-art ones that are now available. AA Navigator, again, is a piece of software that comes on a small little SD disk and you put it into your Palm Top or a device like that. And the three of them all require you to also have a GPS locator, which communicates via Bluetooth with your device, your laptop or your phone or your Palm Top. And the fourth one was Sony's NavView, which is a dedicated system that fits on the dashboard of your car and probably sticks to the windscreen of the car. So they were the four systems.
Okay, so a dedicated one and then three others which kind of bolt on to other technology you might have.
Exactly.
Now, Leanne O'Donnell, you live in West Cork. You've taken the four of these for a test drive. Which one worked best for you?
Well, the Sony SatNav worked best, I think. That's the dedicated piece of equipment that sits in your car, and it's got a GPS locator built in, so you just need one piece of equipment in your car and off you go. And the reason it worked best was because I found it the clearest instructions and just the easiest to use, basically.
When you say instructions, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about a kind of slightly electronic voice with the accent of a nicely brought up young English lady telling you to turn left in 200 metres. this kind of thing. They're the instructions. They come through their voice instructions, and they tell you when a turn is coming up and which turn to take.
OK, so it actually talks you through the route in advance. Peter Mooney, in Dublin, which was your favourite?
Well, I actually liked the co-pilot, the mobile phone one. Now, it had the disadvantage in that you have to have the separate GPS locator that you stick on the dashboard of your car. What I liked about it was that you could take it out of your car. So if you were somewhere, say, in a strange city, or let's say I arrived in Cork, it would navigate me to Cork. And then if I needed to find my way from the car park to wherever I was going, I could bring it with me. Now, in fairness, you'd have to hold your mobile phone in one hand and your GPS locator in the other. But I liked that. The other thing that I liked about it was if you went off route, it very quickly put you back on, recalculate it. So if you were driving somewhere, for example, and there were roadworks or a diversion or something like that, it more quickly, I thought, than any of the others, decided where you were and then quickly recalculated and told you how to get back to where you were going.
OK, Leanne, how did the others perform in West Cork?
Well, the Microsoft Autorouter fell at the first fence, I'm afraid, because it had no maps for where I live. So I think that should come with a bit of a health warning for anyone who lives outside the major urban areas, or indeed anyone who wants to drive outside the major urban areas in Ireland, because it just doesn't have the information that you need. So that one kind of fell at the first fence. And the other one that wasn't such a success, is it was the IPAC with the AA navigator flashcard. It was a bit of an also-ran really there, because the IPAC tended to freeze a bit when I went into the AA navigator. And also, I took it on a test drive to a rural area that I know near my house. And it took me over the most precipitous boreen you could imagine. And it was in broad daylight, so that was quite amusing. But if it had been in the middle of the night, it would have been quite a distressing experience. And I knew that there was a much simpler route, just slightly to the right. So I found that one, I wouldn't like to rely on that one, both from the point of view of the speed of the technology and also from the point of view of the routing decisions the programme seems to make.
Okay,
I think that that's the problem with any of the systems, no matter how good they are. You have to think them. I think Gary Delaney said last week they're advisory, and local, they're no substitute for local knowledge. So if you know your local area, I've tried them, for example, finding my way to my local supermarket. Now I know how to get to my local supermarket, but when I asked them, I wouldn't go the way that any of them suggested. But then they were taking me along main routes, whereas I know sneaky little backways.
Peter, what did you think of the various systems?
I said I liked the co-pilot, but I agree with Leanne that as an in-car system, I liked the Sony One too. I thought it worked well and it was easy to operate. The AA One, when it worked, was grand, but like Leanne also, trying on the IPAC, it stalled. And I don't know whether that was the AA or the IPAC, but it's designed to work on those kind of handheld devices, and there was a problem with that. Microsoft Autoroute had no maps outside of the main urban areas, and it's useless. And as Leanne said, it should come with a health warning. But I did use it travelling in Britain on the motorway system, and I used it in France, and it was actually grand there. Now, the only problem is that I used it on a laptop, so that's a bit bulky. But it certainly worked fine there when it worked. But for Ireland, no maps.
OK, so certain caveats there. In that case, Leanne, what would you recommend to somebody who's interested in buying one of these things?
Well, it very much depends on what you want it for. If you're going to be doing a lot of driving and you want a really reliable system, again, I think the Sony SatNav, the dedicated SatNav system, is your best bet. I mean, I think it's more expensive, but it's more comprehensive. And the disadvantage it has is that you're not going to pop it into your bag and wander around town with it like you would with the phone-based co-pilot system that Peter favours. So that if you wanted a system that you could really just have in your pocket and, you know, use in loads of different situations, the Nokia phone or a similar Bluetooth-enabled phone with the co-pilot flashcard, I would recommend. For example, I got out of the car in Cork and it gave me walking instructions to the RTE studios.
OK. Well, can I just ask the dumb question? I mean, why not just have a map in the car?
Well, I begin to ask myself the same question. The main thing is you don't have to keep looking down, and you don't have to keep pulling over to the side of the road to reevaluate where you are. You tell the machine where you want to go. you head out driving and it does the work for you essentially.
I have to say, I used one of the systems to navigate my way from Holyhead Port to an address in the centre of Preston, and I didn't look at it once, and it took me through some very complicated motorway manoeuvres to within 10 feet of the address in Preston, and that was really very good. And also, I think, Mary, you may remember that we used one just before Christmas to find our way to an address in Selbridge, and it took us really there. And I think it's useful. If you don't know where you're going, they're useful. If you're just driving around a part of the country or the city that you know, well, you don't really need it. It's for people who are maybe travelling a lot in places that they don't go.
Okay, the hard question, how much money are we talking?
We're talking, for the Sony one, you're talking about 250, around that. And there are other systems like the Sony one. There's Garmin and a few other in-car dedicated system. The Copilot one is slightly more than €100. The AA Navigator was 120. And the Microsoft Autoroute is about €70 just for the software. But it comes also with the GPS receiver, which I have to say is a very good GPS receiver. And that's about 140. Can I say the crucial thing if you're buying one is check the maps. The key thing is maps, 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 and then after that, maps. And the maps that were on all the ones that work were Navtech, which, as we mentioned last week, have mapped the roads of Ireland, and other maps are going, other companies are going to come on stream, but they haven't come on stream yet. So if you're going to buy one, just make sure that they have maps of Ireland in them.
Okay, so look for Navtech on the box. Is that the caveat?
I think so.
For buyers, and expect to spend somewhere between 100 and €200. Very good. My thanks to Peter Mooney here in Dublin and Leanne O'Donnell, who took that test drive for us down in West Cork. Now, time for our weekly look at the natural world. And this week, we're looking slightly further afield than usual as we turn our spotlight to the sun. Joining me now is solar physicist Dr. Peter Gallagher from the Physics Department in Trinity College in Dublin. He's a man who, if he's not a sun worshipper, is certainly a keen sun watcher. Peter, do conditions on the sun vary? I mean, can we say that the sun has a climate and weather systems?
Yes, the sun actually has an 11-year cycle of activity, and we're currently sitting at the minimum in solar activity. But in about 5 years' time, we'll get a very stormy sun when there'll be lots of protons, electrons and particles streaming off the sun in what's called the solar wind. So the solar wind really is part of the sun's weather system.
And does the sun's weather system, these kinds of phenomena, do they affect us on Earth?
Absolutely, particularly when you have gusts in the solar wind or solar storms. And during a solar storm, you get a large amount of material being blown off the sun. And these particles that are blown off the sun can affect technologies. They can burn out satellite electronics, for example. Or they can also cause spectacular displays such as the Northern Lights or the Southern Lights, the Aurora Borealis or the Aurora Australis. So they can produce these spectacular displays, or they can affect telecommunications or else satellite electronics.
Now, of course, one should never look directly at the sun. And anyone who looks at sunspots, which is, I suppose, the phenomenon people might be most familiar with, should do it by reflecting it onto a screen. Is there somewhere that people can go to actually look at the sun? Is there a website? Because I know there are lots of instruments that are watching the sun.
Well, this is a problem that we came across about 3 or 4 years ago, and we decided to put a website together. The website is called solarmonitor.org. And in this website, you can browse real-time pictures taken by satellites that the European Space Agency have launched or NASA have launched. But there are also images there taken by ground-based telescopes throughout Europe and even as far afield as Japan. There'll be data there. So we can keep an eye on exactly what the sun is doing across a wide variety of wavelengths. So if you just go to that website, solarmonitor.org, you can browse all these real-time images of the sun. But what's also nice is if there's an eruption, if there's a solar flare or a storm, you can also see a movie of that storm almost instantaneously.
Okay, finally, this is International Heliophysical Year, or shall we call it in English, Year of the Solar System. What kinds of events are you organising? Because you're the person here in Ireland behind this programme.
Yeah, the International Heliophysical Year really is a celebration of the sun and the solar system. There are two components to it. One is the basic research. So research scientists from around the world are coming together to try and understand the sun, how it affects the planets. But also there's an educational component to the programme. So here in Ireland, myself and other researchers in Armagh, Queens and Trinity are going to be going out to secondary schools primarily to give talks to school children, and also to set up some equipment in the schools. So if there are any schools out there that would like to have a visit from a space scientist, then we'd be more than happy to come along and give a talk at the school. So if you want to find out more about that, you can go to ihy2007.ie, which has all the details of how to organise a visit from a researcher to your school.
Excellent. So if anyone would like Peter to come and talk to them, the website is ihy2007.ie, and that's IHY International Heliophysical Year. Dr. Peter Gallagher, thank you very much. That's it for this week. You'll find more information about this week's programmes, including links to those two websites that Peter mentioned, on our programme website, and that's at rte.ie/radio1/quantum. And if you want to contact us in the programme, you can always email quantum@rte.ie. Until next week, from me, Mary Mulvihill, Sláinte Iomail.